The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Thursday, October 20th, 2016. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in Las Vegas, Nevada.
Nevada.
At the Mass Torts Conference 2016, the fall version of the 2016 Mass Torts Conference. A slightly different fare for you today. Slight deviation from our normal programming while we're here. I'm recording some interviews with some attorneys, and we'll have more tomorrow on tort cases, developments in mass torts, corporate malfeasance, just how horrible some people can be in the world. But today we're going to probably focus more on the debate and the final 3 weeks of the campaign. Joining me today, Cliff Schechter will be here, making an early week appearance as opposed to his Friday appearance. Also, anticipating Tom Hartman, maybe Ari Ravenhoff. A lot of folks in town, obviously, because of the debate. And will be joining us. All that and more on today's program. So, folks, we, for the first time, have audio on the from the Mass Torts Conference. And it's not the most dynamic thing you've ever heard, but it's pretty good. But even better than the fact that we have video is that if you are watching the video at this moment, you can see Cliff Schechter sitting here with me. And in fact, Kyle, the godfather of the Majority Report, is sitting in the background. We're not going to give him a mic, of course, but
low
he
energy.
Is here with us. He's low energy. Exactly. All right. So, Cliff, should we play his theme song music? Oh, gosh. I think.
What do you think?
I don't want to make him cry. Play it.
Play it, baby.
No. Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC. New media, public relations, and strategy. You want any of these services? You know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC.
Yes, even so, Cliff, we have had the opportunity to talk in person.
Like a lot lately.
More in the past 2 weeks, I feel like, than probably in the past 3 years.
That's probably true, actually.
But
But I'd prefer if you now, at least from now on, refer to me by my porn name, which is Bad Hombre.
Bad Hombre.
I think I'm going with Nasty Woman too. I think Bad Hombre is a better fit, and I'm going with that.
Well, let's talk about the debate last night. Give me your assessment.
My assessment was, it seems to, you know, there's patterns with Donald Trump. There really are. He controls himself. It seems he's got about a 20-minute span where he can control himself. And in this debate, again, I thought the first 20 minutes was the best of any of the three debates he's done. Because not only did he have some sort of self-control, I mean, yeah, he was still doing the sniffling and all the rest, but he was controlling himself, and he actually had, at least for him, semi-substantive answers on the Supreme Court. On guns, you know, he got the Heller case wrong and clearly didn't know the details, but the fact that he knew that Heller was about guns, that's a step up for Donald Trump.
Well, let me just step in and say that he said Heller after she had said
Oh, that's
Heller.
A good point.
And so I'm not quite convinced.
Monkey see, monkey do.
I'm not quite convinced he knew what that case
he
was.
He may not have. He actually talked about, even though he talked about it in graphic, disgusting terms and lied, he talked about abortion rights. Just so everybody listening knows, and I'm sure anybody listening here does know, no, they don't just grab babies out of the womb. Actually, you do something like that a couple days early. It's called a C-section. It happens a lot. But no, abortions don't take place then. And nothing he said. But the point is that at least it was on issues, which for him is a step up.
Right.
But then, predictably, and in the best sort of goading I've seen since Rocky Balboa took on Clubber Lang and kept putting his fist on his face, she just kept hitting him on all the stuff that I was kind of hoping she would for a while. The little jab she get in about, well, I was talking about this while he was taking $14 million from his daddy and starting his business. And she got in the whole thing about him and the racial discrimination. And she got the little jabs kept coming. The Chinese steel was huge. And she got that in about two or – so she kept jabbing at him. And it took from that 20-minute period where he had control all of 3 minutes to go from probably the best performance he'd been giving so far to by far the worst to being an absolute train wreck. And at that point on being everything – that every swing voter, particularly women, hate about him. Belligerent, insulting. Obviously, I joked before, but the nasty woman comment, which when she said that on a good issue that we like on Social Security, on the payroll tax and raising the amount that wealthier people pay into it, she's like, I'll have to. Donald will if he doesn't find a way to get out of it.
Right.
I mean, she hit him on his taxes. All the stuff, his business acumen, his taxes, you know, his dishonesty, the things that you know get under the guy's skin. And she kept coming with him. And the brilliant part of it is it didn't come off as negative because she did it as little jabs in the midst of substantive answers about things. So it didn't come out, and he would lose it and interrupt, and you know, and so at that point he was an absolute disaster. And obviously the headline everybody's talking about today is the fact that he said he wouldn't accept the results of our election, which I don't know why that's a shock to us because he's been saying that pretty much constantly. You know, he's flipped back and forth.
A month ago in the first debate, he was unequivocal.
Yes.
About accepting the results
of the
election.
But a week before that, he wasn't. I mean, it's just a back and forth thing. Let me just say one more thing, and I'll open it. You know, I want to hear what you have to say, obviously. But the other thing that I think is not a headline from this, and really should be, it's been in the past to a certain degree, but what does it take? I mean, you know, I don't sit here sort of claiming Manchurian candidate all the time, but as this stuff goes on, and he refuses to ever once rebuke Vladimir Putin, to ever once say a negative thing about him, to ever once, I mean, if you noticed, he danced around that topic. He would say, oh, well, of course, anybody who hacks in, I would criticize, whatever. But he would not substantively take him on. And he kept, again, saying how he was stronger as a leader and whatever. I mean, I have no doubt at this point, and I'm sorry, it's not like there's smoke here, with all the advisors he's had, with the business deals, whatever, that he has interests in Russia, that whether he is an unwitting agent or a witting agent, that just like with Golden Dawn in Greece, who they've supported, just like with the Le Pens in France, who they've supported, and other UKIP in England and other far-right parties they know will do their bidding and turn a blind eye when they invade parts of Eastern Europe and do other things, I have no doubt at this point that there's a reason Trump will not ever apologize for him, and you've never seen him once do it. And I think that is such a headline and that is so dangerous. That's my belief at this point. And I'm not saying that due to electoral politics. There's an honest belief that I think Republicans who even think of supporting this guy should be freaking horrified by.
I mean, I wouldn't surprise me if – well, not that it would. I mean, it goes beyond wouldn't surprise me. I'd be surprised if he didn't have a lot of outstanding loans to Russian oligarchs and people who are, you know, high placed in the government or relationships with Putin. I mean, I think he's just too much of a boob to really. I think obviously it's healthy for anybody who is a competitor of ours in the world to have Donald Trump be the president
yes.
of this country. I mean, I still
just
think,
like if they could have gotten Nigel Farage in England,
right.
That would have been helpful too. Yes.
I mean, my sense is this: is that when he made that proclamation, I mean, people watching me on Skype last night. They couldn't. I had no audio during. I wasn't sending audio during the debate.
Were you miming what was going on?
Well, I mean, for the most part, I was just sitting there going like, "Social Security, goddamn that question." And but I am quite convinced. I haven't looked at the tape, but I'm quite convinced when he said that, I just said, "Holy shit!" Because I found that very surprising, and not for the reason is this is that. That is so clearly an answer you give if you have already said, I'm going to lose this election.
Right.
I mean, that answer so clearly to me indicated that what they're trying to do here is just lose in a certain way. That the idea of winning,
grievance, angry, and then rip the 30% of the conspiracy nuts away from the Republican Party, have themselves a little movement they monetize through all a large media empire online, TV, radio.
And
I don't
maybe
think people are,
political aspirations.
I don't think
of
people
Donald
are thinking
Jr.
big
I mean,
enough
no, yeah,
about
and,
what they're going to plan to try to do with that.
I mean, not
just TV.
I think what last night was the start of, and I would say this not just in terms of Trump, but I would also say this in terms of Clinton. Last night is really, in some ways, the first day after the election. Or
yeah.
I should say, or marked the election. Because when he said that, that was so clearly a comment that was going to drive everyone away. And it's not like this guy has, you know, like, well, I don't want to say that I'm going to accept the results because I'd hate on November 9th to say, like, I don't accept the results.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like he's concerned that somebody is 3 weeks is going to call me a liar.
Right.
4 weeks ago, he said he would accept.
Yeah, not, yeah.
He said it that way.
And the other
because
thing?
Because he's very, very concerned about alienating the people he wants with
That's
him
right.
after the election.
And the other thing I would say that to me adds to that is it's almost like an obsession. Everyone, every time he talks, the speeches, the debates, getting out there and making sure to say, black people live in this horrible slums and they're all killing each other and you can't walk down the street without getting shot. It's so calculated to go to his white supremacist base. It's so calculated. You know, that didn't even fit into what he was talking about last night. He didn't need to say that, but he went out of his way to insert that statement that's been fed to him by Bannon and the rest of them because that's how he...
Well, I think he also believes that.
Well, I do, but the point is it allows him to pretend like he's going to make things better as if he could care, but really the goal of that is to remind the people he wants to leave the party with him and come and join his empire and freely give away their Social Security checks to him and his buddies. He wants to remind them why they're with him.
Yeah, and I, you know, there was a lot of that last night in terms of Trump. I really do think that he is contemplating. I mean, that to me was just the whole, you don't need to know anything else about the debate. I also, you know, I knew that it was going to get picked up and that was going to be the story of this debate.
Of course.
And
most election cycles, Nasty Woman could be a good headline coming
right.
out because it was so inappropriate. But in this one, when you say something that, you know, is the very basis of our democracy and our, you know, I mean, I can criticize a lot of Republicans and criticize a lot of Democrats in the past, but so many of them, in so many cases, I mean, Al Gore had a real case for refusing to give in. A lot of people on the left didn't want him to, even after that Supreme Court decision, and just saying, this is ridiculous. There's a law in Florida that says they're able to count, they're able to vote. He could have led a grievance movement. In the end, the Supreme Court decided, as corrupt a decision as it was the right thing to do for the stability of the country, and Al Gore did it.
But it's not the equivalent. Because
no, I know it's not, because he did the right thing.
No, because... It's not about asking him after the election and seeing the – it is the presumption that, yes, of course I will.
Right.
You know, like, I mean, that's the thing, is that Al Gore would have definitively said
– Mm-hmm.
I would imagine he wouldn't have said, like, you know, he can't predict that the Supreme Court – he would have said, of course I'm going to take the
– Of course he would have.
So
would have
George Bush at that time. And then if he had litigated even gone further than he did,
I guess I just bring it up because you saw the commentary last night, right? The BS coming out of Kellyanne and on certain where they were trying to compare it to Al Gore. And I guess the only reason I brought it up is because there was nothing at all similar to those two things. It was a very specific case where there was a state law that said those votes should be counted. And Al Gore went to the lengths that the law would allow him to do. He kept his people calm. He didn't cause a Brooks Brothers riot. That was the other side. He did everything within a democracy and then graciously, knowing that he had won 500,000 more votes and almost definitively, beyond a shadow of a doubt, had won Florida too, got up anyhow and did what was right in our democracy. And the fact that this guy is not doing what is right before it even comes down, because, you know, I mean, the dude may have just lost Texas last night. He is going to get an electoral arse-whipping of the kind that we haven't seen since maybe 88, and I can't wait for it.
I you know, I watched one of those focus groups with the two lines, right, men and women. And this occurred to me, too, at that moment when he said this. That, what he said, like, I'm going to keep you in suspense, was where he lost the Republican men.
Yeah.
right? I mean, that is like, because that's about, you know, honor and all these like sort of like, there's a certain machismo.
There is.
In
not being,
you know,
all whiny.
In terms of like losing with nobility and dignity, whatever.
Right. I mean, you have a duel in the South. There's a history of this kind of thing.
And it's reflected in those dials, frankly. It was interesting.
I'm just saying, if you live in Texas and Georgia, your states may have been handed over.
Like the Kellyanne Conways and those guys, they're just out there trying to make sure that he doesn't go under 40, right? I mean, because they don't want to be embarrassed. And so she's going to walk around, you know, in 6 weeks and be like, if it wasn't me, the guy would have been 30.
I think he is going to go under 40.
And I think it's...
I think we're looking at like a 50-39 or 38 type final, with Gary Johnson getting about 7, Jill Stein getting about 2, maybe even Evan McMullen, because if he wins enough in Utah and the other 10 states, he may even get a point overall. I think that gets you pretty close to 100. I'm not doing the math on it right now. I think she's going to win by 11 or 12 points.
Yeah, people understand, like, for her to win by 11 or 12 points is just enormous. And I don't think he did a very good job last night of basically driving up her negatives.
No.
All right, but let's move on to the other side of this, because there's her responses in terms of policy, and it was very sort of like, I have to say, I predicted when they were announced that Chris Wallace could very well be the most policy-oriented of the debates. Because
gotta give credit.
Well, because Fox,
I mean, they framed it in a way.
There's a certain hostility. I don't like the way that they ask the questions.
Of course,
like, the framing of the questions. But
of course,
Fox,
the debt is a huge problem. And then you have like Nouriel Roubini and others being like, no, actually,
no,
not.
Of course it's not. Well, no,
but you know, yeah.
And Social Security is going to run out of money. All this stuff. But the idea being that, you know, this is the way that Chris Wallace could express his hostility towards Donald Trump, because I think he's not
a Trumper. No,
he's not a Trumper. He's just sort of like a, you know,
he's
a George Willian.
A center right kind of DC. You know, exactly. Charter schools and entitlements. He's probably socially liberal. Yeah,
but there was a couple of things that wasn't, you know. That I didn't think Clinton handled particularly well. I mean, she struggled a little bit, even with like the abortion rights. It seemed to me.
I didn't think
she sort of landed it at the end, but it took her a long time to get there. I mean, I think to a certain extent they're sort of thrown off. I mean, it was surprising that the first question we would hear about choice.
Well, and then Trump got so graphic with it. But the point is that she should be ready to say. And I thought she gave a strong in the end. A very strong defense of abortion rights, but I will agree with you. Early on, she was flubbing it. And, of course, you know, issue I care a lot about, I didn't like her answer on guns. I thought she gave up. I mean, to a certain degree, but she said individual
right.
There is not an individual right. There has never been an individual right. It doesn't exist in the Constitution. It was invented out of whole cloth by the Federalist Society, pushed for years, and when you still had people like, what's his name, Berger, you know, conservative justices saying this is a hoax and there's nothing in the law that says this. And they finally found barely a majority, 5 people on the Supreme Court, to ratify this radical, ahistoric notion. And as I say to people who don't know the gun issue as well, it is as ahistoric as Citizens United. It is to guns what Citizens United is to spending money on elections in our history. And so, no, it's not going to change, you know, my feeling and whatever, but she's going to need to be educated about that along the way.
My guess is that
she probably knows the right answer and just, yeah.
That was a strategic political answer.
Sure.
I mean, I don't want to come out of this debate with anything I say be the headline.
Right.
That's what her agenda was.
That's right.
But with that said, you know, you should be able to say, and I have to say, like, yes, I don't know that I would have been prepared at that moment, but to say, like, the procedure you're talking about, extraction and dilation, when he was talking about partial birth abortions, happens in, 1% of the cases.
It's even less. It's like a 1/10 and 1%, and it's only when a woman's life and health is in major danger.
You should have that data right there.
That's right.
And you are trying to scare people. It took her a while to get there.
That's right.
The other one was the Social Security. Now, she did say raise the cap.
She got there eventually, but initially, yeah, she just said I wouldn't cut it. And you're sort of sitting there like, okay, that's half the equation.
Well, her expansion was limited. She was a little bit more, less specific in the expansion towards the end of the primary.
Yep.
And then she sort of retreated to where she started or was mid-primary, which is expand it for the most needy on Social Security.
Right.
As opposed
I
to a universal expansion.
I think she can be gotten to the right place. To me, well, I would say...
Look how... We had... we mentioned this a bit, but back in 2015, we had all but two Democrats who were not there who voted for expansion of Social Security across the board. And so much is going to be a function. And this is a conversation like that I think...
I think she's going to be the most progressive president we've ever had because she's going to have to be.
Well,
because that's where the party is.
I don't know.
The energy is. That's where the Senate is at this point.
I mean, she could also maybe afford to be if there is no opportunity to pass any legislation. But my point is that we need to wait and see. Or I should say, now it seems to me is the time for progressives to start making an agenda. Like, there's a 10, 15, 20% chance maybe, let's say, that Democrats take the House.
Mm-hmm.
But there should be an agenda there. Like, you know, what is Social Security expansion? I mean, if the Democrats have the House and the Senate.
That's right. And I hate to think so far ahead, but I would say to people also, is you want to start pushing solid messaging and start getting out in front of the fact that in 2018, you've got the Joe Manchins and Heidi Heitkamps and John Testers, let's not call them the Fortitude crew, who, if you come at them with anything they consider to be liberal, are going to try to run away.
Yep.
And so you need to be ready to engage those people and their staff now, like as soon as the election is over, and make them know.
And the Democrats coming in, because you could be looking at a Democrat from Missouri who's not necessarily going to be open to these things. Maybe it's Evan Bayh.
That's true.
The incoming class of Democrats...
You'll have Russ Feingold.
You'll have.
We don't know if McGinty wins, which, right, I think she will. We don't know what she's going to be like. I don't know anything about the one from right here, from Nevada, how progressive she is or
Messed
not
up.
Is.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine Harry Reid is a full on Social Security. I mean, if there's one thing you could say about,
right,
Harry Reid in terms of his.
I imagine she may be. I'm just saying she's a Latina woman. There's, yeah, a lot of ways that I would think she would be more progressive, but we don't know for. So, yes, there's some unknowns there. There's some known unknowns. Sorry, I'm not going to get into Rumsfeld. Right. But people need to take a look. You're right. The new members coming in and take a look, because there's a lot of seats up in 18. Some of them are in very safe places, so it's not a big deal. But a couple of those ones in some of those states I mentioned, and probably a few I'm not thinking of, I think Claire McCaskill's up too.
Mm-hmm.
You need to get in front of these people, and you need to make sure they know that there's a few things that just got to get done, and you're not going to forgive them not getting done.
Well, I mean, the other day Chuck Schumer came out with a statement to the effect of, like, you know, big corporate tax cuts coming. And like, so you can already start to see the next iteration of the grand bargain. And
although,
frankly,
there
I
can be
mind,
a corporate tax cut as long as they make sure everybody pays at the rate they're supposed to.
I mean, yes. And
that's
and,
actually tax reform, and I'm in favor of that.
You know, and the reality is usually what happens is they
lower it, and then they don't make everybody pay to the, and that's a problem. Yes,
that's a problem. But with all that said, would I trade a lowering of corporate taxes for a universal expansion of Social Security? Yes,
or
I definitely would.
Healthcare, for that matter. And let me say one other thing that's incredibly important to me after that debate. That, again, yes, Chris Wallace came talking about policy, but, of course, he came talking about policy at the angle they talk about it from Fox News, as we said. The fact that we just had three debates and global warming, climate change was not mentioned, is a catastrophe
believable.
Of which, because people need to be educated. These are the audiences of 50, 100 million where people can, I mean, we've got a situation already where in Miami Beach, sometimes in high tide, the water's running up a block or two.
Yep.
It doesn't even take a storm. Like, this is something we're going to be dealing with very, very soon, and it's an economic issue because the cost of dealing with this is not going to be nothing, and she could have have. I will criticize Hillary Clinton a little bit because she's got this race won. She kind of knows it. And I would love to see a bold plan that talks about creating jobs and talks about, and maybe there is one, and I just haven't seen it, and that's my bad, but that she could have talked about and educate people on some of this stuff, like what's going on in Miami, like what's going on in Louisiana, like what could happen to New York in not that long a period of time, and what we need to do, and how it's going to be a jobs program, and we're going to create jobs for people while we solve, and we're going to use American know-how and technology to solve this.
I mean, I have to say, it is such an indictment of the media that climate change. And I get,
and most of them live on the coasts too.
It's
amazing.
I get the idea that, like, you know, if you look at the polling, voters, it's not high in voters' minds or whatever.
But that's partially a reflection of the media not covering it.
Indeed, but nevertheless, I mean, I think everybody knows it's an issue, and at the very least, it's like. It's not like this would have been like everybody nods their head on the stage. You have one candidate who thinks it's a hoax.
A Chinese perpetrated candidate, hoax.
You have another candidate whose policies may be a little bit misaligned in terms of actually going full forward. I mean,
that's
this is
right.
Someone who is, she's not.
Make her say what she's going to do because we need, you need a chance to talk to her about what needs to be done.
Where there's drama on her side, even though she's going to say, of course, global climate change, she's going to say all the right things, but you could create. You know, I'm just saying.
And she's from New York State, and her family lives there. The media live on the coast. I mean, look, I live in Cincinnati. They don't do anything but this. I'm going to have beachfront property. I'm going to be fine.
Right. You're going to be fine, except for the refugees who are going to come and take everything you own.
Well, I'm very friendly. We like to invite people over. I mean, look, I kid, but in all seriousness, for people who are going to have to deal with the effects sooner rather than later, who live on coasts or whatever, that to me is, it's almost criminal. I mean, how can you not talk about it?
And I understand that the strategy from her perspective is, I want to come in, I don't want to be the story. The only thing I want to be the story is just like, I showed up, spoke competently.
But she has an infrastructure plan. I don't see why this couldn't be wrapped in as part of
that. There's no reason why at one point she couldn't have said, look, I know we're not talking about this. We're talking about ISIS again for the 4,000th time. But there is a very big threat to our national security, as said by the CIA.
All the agencies that Trump doesn't believe on Russia.
All these things.
All 17
of them,
sure.
The global climate change is a problem that's going to destabilize the world, and it's going to be obviously a problem for us here. It's going to create food shortages and whatnot.
Mass migration.
And I know you weren't planning to ask this question, but this man thinks it's a hoax. And
that's
the American
saying.
Public should know this.
I wish she had forced it out
60 seconds. You get in, you get out, unless it starts a...
But to me, I feel like she did such a good job and was so presidential in my seeing of it that I can be critical of her on guns or how she didn't get to abortion quick enough or how she should have said more. She should have mentioned climate change. And you know, because I'm holding her to a high standard here. Still, in terms of, and I think, you know, a lot of... I think I saw Stuart Stevens... send it out, Mitt Romney guy. Obviously, he hates Trump, and he's been very anti-Trump. But saying for one person, one candidate to win all three debates as convincingly as she did, you know, basically never happens. People forget that first debate when Romney cleaned Obama's clock, you know, 4 years ago. And so she had a pretty masterful time. And, you know, it made me, I'm a supporter, but feel more comfortable with her command of facts and issues. And, I mean, she felt like a president. Standing next to one of those creepy clowns that sneaks out of the woods, you know, and tries to kidnap your kids.
Yeah, I mean, she seemed presidential to me. I mean,
But that matters to me because it's how seriously people take somebody in the world, and these things have implications for foreign affairs and other things. That's one thing that Trump's actually right about. He doesn't get that he doesn't come off that way when he thinks he does. He comes off as a joker so that no one would take him seriously. But how you present yourself does affect how international affairs works, and I think that that's a strength of hers. So, yeah.
All right, let's go to some sound that we had from the debate. Well, you want to get to that?
Oh, I do so badly.
All right,
Bill Kristol and Joe Scarborough going at it. I mean, does it get any better?
Matt, can we tee this up?
Yeah.
Okay. This was just too precious. I mean, because, I mean, look, the bottom line is, I thought there would be a lot more of this. It's unfortunate there hasn't been. But
just for a pure entertainment value.
Pure entertainment value, but also for the good of the country. And
so there was a segment on MSNBC yesterday where Rick Wilson was mocking AJ Delgado or whatever. You know, Rick Wilson's one of the other breakaway, and that was a lot of fun too.
All right. Well, here is Bill Kristol on Joe Scarborough's show this morning, Morning Joe, and let's listen.
It doesn't mean that there's going to be violence in the streets. Certainly not if others now say that. Who cares what Donald Trump says?
So what should Republicans say?
Fluke presidential candidate.
What should Republicans say?
He should be ignored on election night, and Republicans need to say that.
Wait,
and especially,
he
won the nomination in a fluky way.
Not a fluke.
Well, I hope
it
was a fluke.
He beat like 16 people.
He did, and that's unfortunate.
The Republican Party nominated him.
I agree, and some Republicans have refused to support him, and he's going to lose the general election.
That's not a fluke.
And I think it was a fluke in some ways, and in other ways, he tapped into some deep anxieties. I mean, he got a minority of the vote.
A fluke is something nobody
expected. He got a minority of the vote. Okay, fine. You can blame the Republican Party. You feel bad. Does that make you feel better? Does that make you feel better about it?
You
feel great because the Republican Party nominated a guy who's really a bad guy as president. And you think it's funny and amusing.
No, I actually think Republicans need to come clean on themselves.
Well, thank
including
you.
Including leaders of the Republican Party.
What does come clean on themselves mean?
Just they oppose. Be honest about what's right and wrong. And
well, what's wrong is Donald Trump. This show was very tough. This show was really tough on Trump in late 2015 and early 2016. Are you going to pretend that?
We were.
Oh, fine. If that's your way of rewriting history.
You mean when
that's
Joe hung up on him and he wouldn't answer a question?
A lot of people accommodated Donald Trump at different times. I think but I'm not going to get into it.
You just did. Lied. Please don't come on my air and lie. You said in late 15, in early December 2000, I can't even believe you're doing this. I don't know why you're so bitter.
I'm not bitter. I'm trying to say the Republicans.
You're practically crying.
In early December
2015, we compared it to Germany 1933.
Oh,
what he was doing.
Really?
Oh, really? We've got. You know.
And you treated him that way when he called in. Is that right?
Well, yeah, we treated him.
You treated him tough. You asked the most tough questions.
We did.
Look, we don't need to get into this.
It's too late. You're bitter. You come on here practically crying. We've got it on tape. You're screaming at Mika. You don't even know what she's going to say, which is the same thing that you were going to say. Why is Paul Ryan? That's what Mika was going to say.
Well, we're in agreement.
Then don't attack us. Why does Paul Ryan still endorse him? Why does Mitch McConnell still endorse him? Why do all these Republicans still endorse him? It's a great question. While you're attacking me personally, I said from the beginning I would never vote for him.
I said I was voting
for Jeb Bush. I said I was voting for John Kasich. Then we said after the Muslim ban that this is what Germany looked like in 1933. So I don't know I'm sorry we were easy on him. If comparing him to Hitler in 1933 is going easy on him, and like that was 3 months before anybody voted, then we were easy on him.
All right, Matt. We've heard enough. And joining us now is Tom Hartman. Let me just say, you'll notice in this, he said, like, I was voting for Jeb Bush. I was voting for John Kasich. We called him Hitler. But even to stop Hitler, Joe Scarborough can't say I'm going to vote for his opponent.
Yeah.
In the primary. Now, of course, we also know that, yes, he almost Morning Joe almost invented the idea of Donald Trump calling in whenever he had.
I was going to say, you know, Scarborough in 2015 and 2014.
Yeah.
Scarborough set this thing up. I mean, he's been the number one cheerleader for Donald Trump.
They were French kissing off camera. I mean, they showed a couple times, right, when they went to commercial. And they're sitting there, and they're talking about getting together. I mean, Joe Scarborough, literally, I'd like to see him in a debate on that stage with Donald Trump, because I don't know who's more thin-skinned.
Right.
The moment you say anything negative, Scarborough loses it. But, I mean, anybody who was watching, and I forced myself because I find that show abhorrent, half the time he was sitting there talking, Donald Trump this and Donald Trump that, and he's calling it. I mean, what a joke.
There were the tapes released of the conversations, you know, during the break.
So,
I mean, and then the other aspect is, like, that's a great question. Why Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell have stayed with Donald Trump? That's a great question, but there's an easy answer, too, that, you know, I think is the sort of is the bridge that the media has not been able to cross for the most part, which is Donald Trump did not appear out of nowhere. He was not dropped down by aliens and anointed the leader of the Republican Party. And it's not like the Tea Party created Donald Trump. John McCain had to put Sarah Palin on the ticket in 2008, or he would not have been able to get out of that convention. At least that's what he thought, right? So there's a natural progression here. And the media seems to be completely in denial about the fact that there are 35 to 40% of the country that have made him the Republican nominee or consider
and,
him.
And a big percentage of that, within that, of that party, I know Tom is a historian and love those two. To me, that part of it was with Palin in 08, but one of those turning point moments to me where you knew that these guys had lost all control. I've said this, I think, on your show before. 2010, you have Mike Castle, who is this moderate Republican. He had co-sponsored stem cell research bills. He had done all sorts of, he'd worked with Democrats. He's a direct descendant of Benjamin Franklin. He is everything a Republican establishment could want, and probably at that point, one of the most moderate to liberal Republicans there, and had been governor, I don't know if he'd been a senator before, but he'd been governor and county commissioner, all this kind of stuff. And they have somebody saying, I'm not a witch, who has no political experience, Christine O'Donnell, who literally is a crazy person. And when that party said, I'm going to look at this guy of achievement and accomplishment and political pedigree, and I'm going to choose her in Delaware. This wasn't in Alabama, and this wasn't, to me, at that point, it was quite clear that that party had lost all control, what the establishment was. And you're right. And that, they needed Palin. And then that's how we got to this, because these are the people that control the Republican primary process. They control it.
Right. Yeah. And I think this is the most interesting thing that happened last night, was that by not melting down, what Donald Trump did is double the pressure on Republicans who are trying to have their cake and eat it too. They're trying to say, oh, yeah, Donald Trump, it's all good. But, like Paul Ryan, I'll endorse him, but I won't campaign for him. Yeah, right. How's that working for you? Had Trump really blown it last night, these guys could have gotten out with their skin intact.
That's right.
But they can't now. And, they own him, and they own this. And you're right. This is not, Donald Trump didn't fall out of the sky. In fact, I would submit that this is the logical result of a bunch of cranky right-wing, mostly libertarian billionaires basically staging a hostile takeover of the Republican
Party.
Absolutely.
There's so much cash flowing through the right that it has misaligned a whole series of incentives. Eric Erickson had a piece that he wrote about it was about his relationship with Jesus and
his health stuff. I read that piece.
But the big part about it was how he was afraid he was going to lose listeners. He was afraid he was going to lose readers. He was afraid he was going to lose money. And the flip side of that is, why was this guy getting money in the first place?
Right.
That's right. Why was he getting?
And where was it coming from?
Why did he have so much at stake in the first place?
Well, Dave,
and that's because there's so much money sloshing around on the right that people could afford to misalign and to take things and to actually pursue them in such a way. And Trump is the embodiment of that. Last night, and Tom, you're right, because there was, I'm sure, Paul Ryan, when Donald Trump was asked that question about, will you accept the results? Paul Ryan was going, please say no. Please say no. Because if Trump had said no, unequivocally no, Paul Ryan can announce the next day,
I'm sorry,
this is too far. This is the bridge too far. But he said, I'm not going to tell you.
Yeah, that's right. And, suspense.
And so it was, they're just twisting in the wind.
Yeah.
And I think, I think that was probably calculated by Trump, too.
I
think
they... Well, and there's another piece to this. Ken Vogel did a brilliant piece for Politico about a year and a half ago that I thought was the most important political news story of the year, and it just completely got ignored. It was it just dropped into nothing. And it was about how Limbaugh is getting about a $5 million a year subsidy that goes right into his pocket from right-wing think tanks. Hannity was around $4 million. He went through the list of all these right-wingers who are basically getting money on the side for doing their shows, and it's called, quote, sponsorship. But these are not ads that are running in rotation. These are, you know, it's like Heritage Foundation, these kind of groups.
Yep.
And they're, you know,
it's like
speaking
a retainer.
Fees.
It's a
retainer.
Right, the Dick Army group, right? Didn't they give
there's,
something
there's
like
a
that?
Bunch of them.
Just
I mean,
to be invited on the show and say nice things about their Tea Party group.
With Glenn Beck.
Yeah, and I'm not even sure that there was a quid pro quo. It's more like, you know, okay, we're going to support our team. There's nothing like that infrastructure on the left.
Oh, God.
And this is just the smallest little tip of the iceberg.
That's right.
You know, so much of it is buried underground. The fact of the matter is that, at least if the press reports are right, Americans for Prosperity, which is the Koch brothers' political arm, essentially, has more employees than the Republican Party,
yes.
has more field offices than the Republican Party, has a much better database than the Republican
yes.
Party, which they're keeping proprietary.
Three times the staff.
Yeah,
the RNC.
Yeah. They've got a hell of a lot more money.
Yeah, they had an $890 million plan originally.
Yeah,
and
they're executing it. And that's the only reason I would submit to you that AFP and similar groups are the only reason why people like Rob Portman are still in the race. That had they not been there, they're throwing millions and millions and millions
right.
of dollars into down ticket races. Which will benefit Trump. I mean, they're saying very nobly, oh, we're not supporting Donald Trump. Well, I'm sorry. If you turn out the Republican vote in Ohio for Rob Portman, you're going to, you know, people are going to vote the top
That's
of the ticket.
Right. Yep.
And so it's...
Right. And, you know, you hear about it. And look, I'm not saying I think all money should be out of politics. But when you hear someone like Dustin Moskovitz of Facebook gives $20 million, which he did, to various super PACs on the left because he's scared of Trump... You know, that gets this big headline, and that's a one-time $20 million donation. What people don't get is this $890 million kind of – this is a constant thing.
Oh,
this
and has been for 30 years.
Right.
Ever since the Powell memo,
right.
basically.
And that's just one group of people. We can go for a walk up the street to the Venetian and see Mr. Adelson and try to find out what he – you know, we know some things he's – but we don't know plenty of the money he's been putting in. I mean,
right.
it's just – it's non-ending. Yeah. I did some work with NARAL about a year or two ago to trace where some of the money was coming from. And it was all these guys who say, I'm pro-choice, like the Koch brothers say, and Adelson says. But they're willing to fund the Susan B. Anthony group, and they're willing to fund all these like rabidly anti-choice groups because, hell, as long as you're with us on our libertarian economics, we don't really care. Sure, we're pro-choice, but they couldn't care less.
It's all about the money.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Republican voters don't get. You know, is they're being played for suckers, you know,
yep.
whether it's guns, gays, God, abortion, you name it. They're being played for suckers because it's all about the money.
I want to ask you about, I mean, because one of the things I think when Trump had that to say last night, which, you know, is obviously the big story today, that he's backed off his pledge from a month ago to accept the results of the election.
Mm.
It seems to me that that was the beginning of the Clinton presidency in terms
yeah.
of where people are lining up. So from the perspective of, let's just take it from the perspective first of the right, like, there's this sense that I get that, like, people think once he loses, we go back to some measure of normalcy.
No.
And that's not going to be the case at all.
Because AFP and these other groups are still there, and they're still more powerful than the Republican Party.
And Donald Trump's not going to go anywhere.
No.
Like, you know, it's not like all of a sudden, like, there will be, this is a slight exaggeration, but I'm not convinced that the media wouldn't cut away from Clinton's acceptance speech to Donald Trump's concession speech.
Yeah.
Like, he could say, like...
He may cut away from her inaugural to...
honestly, like, it wouldn't surprise me if he said, like, I'm not going to give a concession. She finally comes out and says, I'm going to give an acceptance speech. And then he walks up on there, and they, like, go, like, oh, my God, we got to cut to him. Like... I think, and that, to me, I think is going to be the dynamic going forward. And the pressure on Paul Ryan, I mean, presuming that we're looking at a Clinton win, a Democratic Senate, and a House that has a 10 or 15 person as opposed to a 30 person majority for the Republicans. You've got an empowered Freedom Caucus. You've got a terrified...
Which really should be called the Koch caucus.
Right.
Right.
Indeed.
For a variety of reasons, but yeah.
And it's going to be just crazy. And Donald Trump, with his announcement last night, was basically saying, like, I know I can't question where you were born. But I can question the legitimacy of your presidency.
Well, look at what McCain said.
Yeah.
We're not going to consider her Supreme Court
nominees.
We're never
putting one on, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he's worried that maybe he lost some people on the far right with saying he's no longer supporting Trump. So he thought to himself, I have to say something completely nuts.
Got to throw some red meat to the base.
To get that group back in.
What's the game of chicken in the Senate in terms of getting rid of the filibuster for SCOTUS? All right, because if the Democrats take control of the Senate, they could at any time, now we know, could get rid of the filibuster for Supreme Court justice. They did it for appointments to the executive. They did it with appointments to the federal judiciary below the Supreme Court. Game this out for me, because the Democrats know that in 2018 they're probably going to lose the Senate.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't know for sure.
Right.
But
it's going to be more Democrats defending seats, number one. And number two, they're low on, you know,
West Virginia and Montana and Heidi Heitkamp off in North Dakota. They're going to be some tough ones.
Yes.
So what is the with John McCain saying that, does that change the calculus of Chuck Schumer? Or is John McCain calling up Chuck Schumer and saying, like, I just had to say that because I got to save my ass?
I think it all depends on how seriously PO'd Hillary Clinton gets. The difference, and I'm speaking hopefully here, I may be completely wrong, but in retrospect, it looks to me like when Barack Obama became president, he had this incredible opportunity, but he did not know how to use power. This is a guy who had only been a senator for a couple of years, and most of that time was spent campaigning. He did not know how to take names and kick ass. That's what FDR knew how to do when he came into the White House. That's what Lyndon Johnson knew how to do.
That's right.
These guys are guys who had not just played the game; they had put people up against the wall physically.
I know.
And Obama, you know, God bless him. I mean, he brought a lot of dignity to the office. He elevated the perception of the office, but he has never been willing to take on Republicans in the way that is just an absolute, you know, take names, kick ass way. And Hillary Clinton has the ability to do that.
That's right.
She knows how to use power. And if she will do that, and I think she will, I think this is all going to depend on her, because she's got the bully pulpit. It's not about the Senate and the Senate Republicans. It's about how much support they're going to get from the White House. I think that there could have been a lot more done.
I think she's better with both the carrots and the sticks.
Yes.
Because there have been a number of them who've said, a number of Republicans, for example, Lindsey Graham had been involved in the impeachment of her husband, and yet she formed an alliance with him on a variety of issues, I think veterans issues.
Yeah.
So she's shown that ability, and I'm not criticizing. I think Obama brought a lot of the positives that Tom said to the office. But, you know, he did his thing, and then after he was done with his work, he went up and spent time with his kids and his wife, which he should, by the way. But Hillary's not going to be doing that. She's going to be going and meeting with. So I think on the positive side, there's that. But you and I talked about this on your show a whole bunch back then, you know, Sam, which is he had this honeymoon period, you know, of an 80% approval rating. He had won an electoral vote in Nebraska. He had won, you know, in North Carolina. He had won in Florida. He didn't go to people like Mel Martinez or Voinovich in Ohio or Lugar in Indiana and say, here's the thing. You want to oppose me on social issues, whatever, but here are my two or three economic priorities. We are in dangerous times, and I'm going to come to your state. I'm going to barnstorm your state. I'm going to put ads up in your state, and I'm going to tell people why they don't have jobs. It's going to be you. And if she's willing, especially if she wins this election as big as it looks like she could, in a number of states that have Republican senators, you know, you have to think, will they be willing, if she's willing to do that, will your Dean Hellers and your Jeff Flakes and your Lindsey Grahams, if she gets to 51, 52 votes in the Senate, maybe even 53, can she find seven people who say, I don't want this crisis, and I'm willing to, at least even if I don't vote for her nominee, I'm willing to allow the thing to go forward?
Yeah, the last two presidents to use the bully pulpit really effectively to push through policies that were highly controversial were Lyndon Johnson and Ronald Reagan. And they both transformed the nature of American politics and certainly the lives of particularly poor people. Reagan for the worse, Johnson for the better.
Had a Congress. I mean, Johnson had...
He had considerable opposition, too, though.
But he
and
had,
there were some Southern Democrats who were...
Yes, but he had a Congress, and he had to make those trade-offs with those Southern Democrats to a certain extent, and then they jettisoned. But Hillary Clinton is going to come into office, I think... Even if she gets a greater percentage win than Obama did in 2008, She is going to come in with very high unfavorables. It is going to be perceived in the media, and I think very arguably true, that this was a vote against Donald Trump before it was a vote for Hillary Clinton. At the very least, that's going to be the media narrative. On top of that, you have a one woman who came out yesterday on Breitbart, who I thought was very credible, saying that she was assaulted by Bill Clinton on numerous occasions in 1980. Like, that whole narrative is not going to go away. Because as soon as she's elected president, the press is going to be like, okay, now we can do this. We're not empowering a fascist.
That's right.
We can go full hog on this. On the left, there's a lot of people and who are going to be running from the gamut from angry that she got elected to you've got to do something for me now. And I put myself on that spectrum. I want to see deliver. Like, you know, there was a lot of people who listened to her last night say no cuts to Social Security, outlined her expansion, and were left saying, I'm one of them, like, not enough. Not enough. If there's an opportunity to expand Social Security, there better be no argument from you.
Right.
Like, you know, if there's a, if lightning strikes on November 8th or November 28th, and Democrats...
November 28th, by the way, is the day that if you're a Republican, you should vote.
Exactly. Donald Trump told you, and you listen to what he says.
That's right.
That's right. That's like, right. It's like we have... They've made it easier.
November 8th
no
is only for Democrats.
If the Democrats took the House and the Democrats took the Senate, like, you know, day two better be expansion of Social Security.
It better be a small nuclear explosion.
Right. And so on top of that, when Barack Obama took office, they had specifically over that summer told all of their donors no money to outside groups. And so there were no groups that were mobilized. It's not like we have that many right now anyways, but we have some.
But there's some that have been doing it.
There's some that have been doing it. There's no groups who were mobilized who could push back. Because even in 2009, you know, come September of 2009, people were already upset about the bankruptcy bill and the promise that Obama would support the cram down on when people went into bankruptcy, that they could get a principal reduction on their mortgages. When he backed off that, there was people that were upset on the left, but there was nobody around to mobilize against.
Well, and not only that, you had, if you're talking about the 2005 bankruptcy bill, you had Democrats. I mean, Debbie Stabenow came on my radio show and defended the bill, said, you know, I said, well, what about young people who can't declare bankruptcy on student loans? And she's like, well, young people, I mean, that's the perfect opportunity to learn individual responsibility. and
you should forget that when you get older.
The best time to go into bankruptcy is when you're 20.
I really challenged her, and it was the last time she's been willing to come on my show, I'm guessing for that reason. But, you know, generally speaking, Debbie Stabenow is a reasonably good Democrat. But, Joe Biden was the guy
He was a big defender.
Just the defender. He was like the co-author or something. I mean, he was he played some sort of leadership role.
But here's my thought just quickly on this, which is also I always believe in the power of individual voices. I do believe in the bully pulpit. But I also believe when you've got a voice like Paul Wellstone, when he made a difference, you know, he changed people's perceptions. We're not going to get another one of him. We do, however, have Bernie Sanders with a much bigger microphone now than he had going into this election. We do have Elizabeth Warren, who, even when I think she can't get impressive, seems to get more impressive all the time. And we're getting Russ Feingold back.
Right.
Yeah. And these are individual voices. These are people that are willing to stand up and be that one person who doesn't go with the crowd. And I think that is a power, and there's an important power to that, that even if Hillary Clinton is being a little bit sort of dragging her feet on something or other, you know, we've got some very strong progressive voices with very big microphones in front of them, and I'm hoping they can be helpful in this,
too. Well, and I think she's realizing, and they should have realized it before now, that although, you know, I probably shouldn't second-guess her campaign strategies because I'm not a campaign strategist, but if she wants to have two terms, She's going to have to galvanize and mobilize the base, the Democratic base.
Yes.
She's going to have to reach out to the Bernie folks. And she's already gone quite a ways. I mean, you know, 90% of the platform, and now she's bragging about it. She's not just ignoring it the way typically they do. So I'm actually, and I was skeptical of Hillary Clinton. I endorsed Bernie Sanders. I said I support them both, but I'm endorsing Bernie. But I'm actually quite hopeful now because, I mean, again, you look back at 1932, you had this guy who was a plutocrat who was just literally weeks away from being indicted for bribing a federal judge, who was running the Tammany Hall machine, or at least a part of it. He was one of the more corrupt politicians in the United States and, you know, running the most corrupt state. He was responsible for the attorney general who was supposed to supervise Wall Street, which had melted down in 1929 on his watch, and he did absolutely nothing about it. And that guy, Franklin Roosevelt, became the most consequential president of the 20th century, arguably one of the three or four most consequential presidents in the history of the United States, because he knew how to use power. He knew who the players were, he knew where the levers of power were, he knew where the bodies were buried, and he was not afraid to do something about that. And,
well, and
I am hopeful that is hilarious.
I think
also,
of Truman,
let me add one other element to that. He knew how to use power, and he also saw people marching to Washington. Guys going across the country organizing an alternative program to Social Security that would have been far, far to the left of
Social Security. But
that's the
point. If Bernie Sanders has that voice and you have someone there, and Hillary Clinton has proven she knows how to use power, you know, and I said this when people were skeptical and they pointed out the Wall Street connections and what you just said about FDR. Truman had a lot of help from some pretty shady machine, the shady machine in Kansas City, getting to where he got to eventually.
That's how he became vice president.
That's right. And he turned out to be pretty darn good. John F. Kennedy, we know, had mob connections, and he was moving, certainly when he was assassinated, very much in the right direction. I'm just saying, these guys who know to use power, who are willing sometimes to leave aside the more sordid elements of how they got there when they, you know, and I think she could do that.
Yeah. So it's, you know, we're just all kind of holding our breath and hoping, you know, we'll know in January. And I think we'll know by March.
Right. Basically. And, of course, LBJ was a segregationist for a while.
Yeah.
So, I mean.
Oh, yeah. Well, not only that, I remember the book, A Texan Looks at Lyndon, which came out in 66, I think it was. I remember reading it. It's a small book, but it's charging him with murder. You know, when he was a Texas politician, he ran, you know, he had a challenger who was about to take him down, and the guy was assassinated. It's a, it, to this day, I think it's an unsolved
crime.
There's some
questionable ties to, what was it back there, Brown and Root, or, you know?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, which became Halliburton.
Which became Halliburton. There's some questionable ties with LBJ, and I'm just saying, there's some people that came from some ugly places who've done some of the best things in American history.
Bernie's the anomaly. Bernie was the anomaly, a clean politician who was also progressive.
Yep.
But, you know, we don't have Bernie, although he's going to be one of the five most powerful people in the Senate if we can take the Senate.
His voice is, if we take the Senate, his voice in all sorts of affairs. Can you imagine just the tag team of him and Elizabeth Warren speaking on economic issues?
Yeah. I mean the
although Kurt Schilling's now going to run, so I'm scared that we may lose.
Oh, my God.
I'm coming
so
on your show for that.
Palpitations.
He's got the thing set up, Twitter feed. I'm so excited for that.
One other element that concerns me is that, you know, we've already seen Elizabeth Warren. She called for Mary Jo White's
resignation
which is basically her signaling to the Clinton administration, like, don't mess around.
Or with Wells Fargo.
With
Look
your
at what
SEC
she did.
Appointments. Yeah. Yeah. Don't mess around with your financial institution regulatory appointments.
Right.
You're going to have no leeway there. We don't have an analogous situation, it seems to me, on foreign policy. And one of the things that came up in the debate last night was Hillary Clinton's no-fly zone, which, I mean, I think that's, I mean, it's obviously a bit of a bluff, right?
Right.
But it's a very bad bluff.
I've got a boogie. I got to be on my own radio show.
Oh, yeah. All right.
Well, I will say to that, the one thing quickly. Well, let me let you say. Always good talking
Thank
to you, Tom.
You guys.
Thank
it's
you,
great
Tom
to
Hartman.
See you both. And I'll be – actually, I can be back here in 20 minutes if you want, but it's up to you.
Oh, yeah. So, please, come back. It'll be great.
Let me make this call.
Okay, cool. Well, I'll say when you bring that up,
the fact that we almost prevented
Tom doing his show.
From being on his own show.
That's impressive. That's how exciting you are, Sam. I would say, you know what, we haven't – here's the thing I would say.
That's basically – That's my plan for radio domination.
If you get everybody to skip their shows,
yeah.
Your market share just
line.
Skyrockets.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. Russ Feingold, as I remember, tell me if I'm wrong, but I think I remember this, only senator to vote against the Patriot Act.
That's
I correct? He may be your guy on some of these things. He's shown, certainly when it comes to some of the, I mean, Patriot Act is pretty, it may not be foreign policy. It's pretty foreign policy related, though. When it comes to issues of civil liberties, Russ Feingold's your guy, and can he bring that over to issues of war and peace, which obviously has a lot of overlap? Maybe he can be that voice.
He, during his time as not senator, he basically, as far as I can tell, was a law professor and then an envoy who stopped a war in Africa.
These seem like things that are good ways to build your... I mean, he didn't go to Wall Street, and he didn't go and lobby.
Stunning. Like, you know, like sort of the... That is so so anachronistic.
That's
in
right.
The context
that used to be what everybody did, right?
Yeah.
Those kinds of things, and now it's like, what a great guy! You know, he didn't hop, skip, and jump over to where did Eric Cantor go as soon as he lost? Within I don't even know what firm he's at, but
right,
he's you don't have to worry
or
about him.
Evan Bayh, who just sort of lamented
his
this
pension will be he'll be okay.
So all right, let's do a little more sound. Shall we?
Yeah.
You've got your headphones on.
I do.
Here is Donald Trump talking about, and one thing about Donald Trump, he seems to think that senators and first ladies and secretary of states are magic. And that they can
do everything themselves. Why didn't you change that?
Why didn't you keep me from using the tax laws in such a scurrilous way, or from buying Chinese steel, or whatever it is?
Wrong.
And here she is, mocking the 30 years experience line. And this is a good turnaround. I didn't like the way she ended it, but here's.
You know. Back in the 1970s, I worked for the Children's Defense Fund, and I was taking on discrimination against African-American kids in schools. He was getting sued by the Justice Department for racial discrimination in his apartment buildings. In the 1980s, I was working to reform the schools in Arkansas. He was borrowing $14 million from his father to start his businesses. In the 1990s, I went to Beijing, and I said, women's rights are human rights. He insulted a former Miss Universe, Alicia Machado, called her an eating machine. On the day when I was in the Situation Room monitoring the raid that brought Osama bin Laden to justice, he was hosting the Celebrity Apprentice. So I'm happy to compare my 30 years of experience, what I've done for this country, trying to help in every way I could, especially kids and families, get ahead and stay ahead with your 30 years. And I'll let the American people make that decision.
That was, I thought that was maybe her most impressive sort of volley.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there are other one-liners, you know, a quick what quip, but I mean, obviously that was prepared and that was very, very well done.
Right. That was a good one. And I guess the thing I was thinking about was at the end of another run where she said, and maybe this was, I don't know what it was, and it was clearly prepared when she said, like, he said, oh, it was the rigged thing about
the Emmys or whatever.
Yeah. Did we play the Trump refuses to say he'll abide by the election results? We've just been talking about it, right?
Yeah, we haven't played it.
Okay, let's play this because this, again, was so obvious it was going to be the big takeaway from the debate. But more importantly, I think the big takeaway is not just the fact that, like, oh, my God, he's, you know, for the, as if, like, you know, as if, talking about your penis size in a presidential debate was not also sort of an attack on our norms and
right.
The institutions and whatnot.
And, you know, saying you can win if you get shot in Fifth Avenue. He's had a few attacks on our norms, I would say.
The important thing about this is it's an indication that he knows he's going to lose, and he's willing. He's done sacrificing his plans for after the election.
Right.
For, like, a last ditch before the election.
Right.
Here it is.
Your running mate, Governor Pence, pledged on Sunday that he and you, his words, will absolutely accept the result of this election today. Your daughter Ivanka said the same thing. I want to ask you here on the stage tonight, do you make the same commitment that you will absolutely, sir, that you will absolutely accept the result of this election?
I will look at it at the time. I'm not looking at anything now. I'll look at it at the time. What I've seen
is laughing.
So bad. First of all, the media is so dishonest and so corrupt, and the pile-on is so amazing. The New York Times actually wrote an article about it that they don't even care. It's so dishonest, and they've poisoned the minds of the voters. But unfortunately for them, I think the voters are seeing through it.
There is a tradition in this country, in fact,
hold on,
one
pause
of the prizes
for one second. Pause it for one second. He sort of saves himself a little bit. But at one point, he's saying, even if I lose just because all the voters think I shouldn't be president, that's illegitimate.
That's right.
Because their minds have been poisoned.
Been corrupted by the media.
I mean, and I think he realized, like, oh, wait a second. I think I went a little too far by saying, like, oh, but I think they're seeing through that. But still, it's still sort of out
there. And did you hear it?
This is sort of the classic libertarian argument, too. Like, well, the problem is that the American public still wants things from their government.
Right.
Well, yeah, that's not a problem for them as much as it is for your philosophy.
Right, your philosophy is an issue. Even there, like, the whole thing is like, the media has been so terrible to me and they've been so biased, the New York Times wrote a story about
right.
it.
Which but is then like, he has to back off.
So it's like, oh, well, yeah, so the place that's so mean to you actually mentioned they were mean to you. And, I mean, he's hilarious. Go ahead.
Country. Is the peaceful transition of power, and that no matter how hard fought a campaign is, that at the end of the campaign, that the loser concedes to the winner. Not saying that you're necessarily going to be the loser or the winner, but that the loser concedes to the winner, and that the country comes together in part for the good of the country. Are you saying you're not prepared now to commit to that principle?
What I'm saying is that I will tell you at the time. I'll keep you in suspense.
Well, okay? Chris, let me respond to that, because that's horrifying. You know, every time Donald thinks things are not going in his direction, he claims whatever it is rigged against him. The FBI conducted a year-long investigation into my emails. They concluded there was no case. He said the FBI was rigged. He lost the Iowa caucus. He lost the Wisconsin primary. He said the Republican primary was rigged against him. Then Trump University gets sued for fraud and racketeering. He claims the court system and the federal judge is rigged against him. There was even a time when he didn't get an Emmy for his TV program 3 years in a row, and he started tweeting that the Emmys were rigged against
him. Should have gotten it.
This is a mindset. This is how Donald thinks. And it's funny, but it's also really troubling.
I mean, when I heard that in time, I thought that the Emmy thing made it, just gave it too much of, it released the tension.
I agree. I wouldn't have used that either because I know she's trying to point out the triviality of it, but in the end it gave him a little bit of a laugh line.
I actually think now that I listen back, I see what she was doing.
I do.
That was also to make it impossible for him to use rigged in the way that Bernie Sanders used rigged. It was for her to make it that when Donald Trump says rigged, he doesn't care about you.
Right.
He doesn't care about the system being rigged against you. He only cares about rigged in terms of himself.
Now, right, it's not just politics, too. Anything in life that doesn't work out for him must be rigged.
Personal right. for him. He does not care that anything is rigged for anybody.
But I love that you have to have loved the PhD level trolling, and that's why I felt like this is her best performance in terms of trolling and getting, like, when you lost the Wisconsin, when you lost the, I mean, that's part of it too. She knows, when reminding him of everything he loses just drives him nuts. It was brilliant.
I'll keep you in suspense. I mean, folks,
who doesn't like a Democratic Republican suspense?
I mean, it's not just that he could have said. It's not just that he could have said, like, no, of course I'll abide by the results. It was like, I'm going to win. And so I'm going to abide by the results.
Right. But clearly he knows he's not going to win.
Chris Wallace could have said, like, but if you don't win, if I don't win, I'll abide by the results, but I'm going to win. Like, that's how you answer that question 6 months ago. But he knows he's not going to win. And I'll keep you in suspense.
He knows he's not going to win, and he knows he's got a group of people
right.
who he wants to absolutely, when he weighs it in his little brain and sees American democracy, building my media property of disgruntled white guys, that we know which one comes first, and part of that being disgruntled is to feel like an election was stolen from them. That's what's going to make them want to tune in to Donald TV even that much more.
I think it goes even beyond that. Yeah, great. Tom Hartman is back. I wouldn't be surprised if Jared Kushner has a secret compartment in his office. They press a button and the bookshelf walks away and he walks into the control room and they've got the graphics already for the election was stolen tour.
Right.
That is going to go to 25 cities. They're going to go to stadiums. They're going to get up there and they're going to talk about how the election was stored. And like, you can have, or do you have your Trump Platinum card and buy it here? Sign my book. We've already
right.
penned the theft of the 2016 election, and that's the book tour. That I mean, I think it's actually like it's not even like he wants to keep those people through the election.
Oh, yeah.
And after I think that like they're already creating the campaign.
It's part of the process of sort of making sure they come in. And they're part of that whole Donald Trump universe of everything from biblical cancer, and they can email that out to all of them, and they put in money. I mean, just every single way he's going to monetize, and by that I mean rip off this group of people they've built up as followers.
Which, by the way, is a long Republican tradition.
Yeah.
Half of the people in the Republican primary were not running for president of the United States. They were trying to double their speaker fees.
Oh, definitely.
You know, it was all about
Mike
the money.
Huckabee's whole media career is based on that.
Yeah. I think, this is something that I think, for whatever reason, people in our little industry of
progressive talk radio?
Yeah. have an understanding of the right and how that's working, I think, because we're in a business that is I don't know how you would describe it, activist entrepreneurship, right? Mm-hmm. And what I think the establishment media do not understand, and the equivalency police do not understand, is that we are a small segment of the left. There's professional politicians, there's professional activists. We do something that is slightly different, that is entertainment / activism / entrepreneurship. The entire right, not the entire, but we represent a fraction of the left in terms of that dynamic. I wouldn't know what the number is, but I think it's close to 60 to 70% on the right has those same incentive structures that we have on some level. And there's more money, so there's more stakes.
Yeah.
And like, you know, like, look, well, it's like there's no position or public face that we could put on that is really going to make a dramatic difference in our ratings or our
well, look what's happened with trade.
I mean,
all these guys were, you know, trade's the best. We have to have free trade. It's so important for improving the economy. The minute Donald Trump comes along and makes it much more marketable for them to be anti-trade, every one of these guys, Sean Hannity switched on a dime, you know? I mean, they're off and they're against trade because there's maybe two permanent positions, which is hating gay rights, but hating abortion and loving guns. Almost anything else is really kind of... It's whatever you want to make it.
But you can look at it as what happens, like you say, the Republican presidential primary field. I mean, compare the Democratic side. Like, you know, Martin O'Malley's not going to go around selling books right now. He's not.
He was actually running for president.
Yeah. And he legitimately wanted to be president of the United States.
And had the qualifications, by the way.
That's right. It wasn't the Ben Carson sort of scam show where all these guys who glommed on, like right. Armstrong Williams, yeah. you know, who've made millions off of Ben Carson's existence.
We, in 4 years, we're going to see, I think, 20 people run for the Republican.
I think it could get, I'm serious. I think it could get as high as 30 or 40. Who wouldn't? If you're anybody who's got the courage, you know, who has the, you know, is not scared to get up there on a stage. You're a state senator somewhere who's made a name for yourself, like the one here in Nevada, Fiore or whatever, who's always got her gun with her. Why wouldn't she run?
It is a way for them to raise their profile, not just within the party, but also for there's another half a dozen. You know, Newt Gingrich could run again.
Basically, since Reagan, the Republican Party has been a scam. It's
Rick Perlstein wrote a great piece on this at one point. Yeah. The overlap between the sort of the world of scamming people by email and direct mail, Richard Viguerie's role in that, and whatever, and how, you know, one email you're sending to the same group is, again, like, rub this cream on you and you'll have the muscles of Arnold Schwarzenegger. And then the next email is, again, biblical cure to cancer. If you give this much to Mike Huckabee, they're all based on the same principle, the same fears, the same insecurities, and they're sent to the same people. I mean,
The difference between the email blast that came out of the campaigns last night was perfectly telling. Like, I got 40 emails from the Clinton team refuting point by point by point, like every 3 minutes.
Yeah.
And I got the same from the Trump campaign that was like, last chance to give.
That's right.
You buy the bus.
I just opened a new property. Yeah. You got to come see it.
Get a black card with gold type on it.
Exactly.
So you too can be.
Double date with me and Ivanka. I mean, whatever it was, the pitch at the time. It was just the perfect sort of example.
Yeah.
All right, let's listen to some audio of. Do you have headsets?
I do.
I'll sit here through this, and then I'm going to let you have. I have a meeting. I have to go. I'll let you have some time with
great.
Tom, and maybe I'll be around, so I may come back after if you want me to.
Yeah, I think. Well, we got a little more time left on the show today. There was a obviously, Chris Wallace went just straight in, dove right in to policy questions. Didn't like necessarily all the questions.
I think he's the best moderator so far.
Without a doubt.
I do too.
And it cringes me to say that about A, Chris Wallace, and B, a sports or a Fox personality. But
I mean, I thought Lester Holt was pretty good too.
Yeah,
but
he was.
And their coverage after last night, sadly, may have been the best of all three. I remember tweeting and I'm like, I may never say this again. But Britt Hume had his usual sad face on, and he was actually very sad because he was very upset that Trump had said he wouldn't accept the election. Right. Megyn Kelly was actually being somewhat critical of Trump, which is not surprising, I guess, after their history. But, you know, CNN, you're sitting there, it was like the Jeffrey Lord show, you know, just making things up. I mean, Fox has its moments here and there, and then they'll go back to being Fox.
Well, so like sure. I say,
I'm not saying it's long-term.
I'm not so sure about that. I mean, and we can talk about this more. But like I say, I think last night was the first basically signaled like things starting to sort out after the campaign. And one of those things is going to be a new Fox, right?
If Trump takes the far right, maybe they try to be the sort of center right of Shep Smith.
Also, Ailes is gone. You know, there's going to be that battle between the first Uday and Kuse. Being Murdoch's sons, but I think you're going to see.
Well, one of those sons, James, is actually progressive.
Yes,
and an environmentalist, an aggressive environmentalist.
And the other
I went
brother,
to high school with him actually, and he
really?
Always was very. I mean, he was a year behind me. I'm not saying we're close friends or anything, but I knew him, and he actually always was a pretty liberal guy. So
the other brother, not so much.
I never knew him.
And but both of them, I think, are. Have you know get embarrassed by Fox at different times, and there'll be an excuse.
Here's something else to throw into that dynamic too, Sam, and that is Andy Lack coming in and taking over MSNBC and basically moving it in the direction of the cloth coat Republican network.
Yes.
You know, we're going to be the rational Republican network. We're going to be the Joe Scarborough network. Joe Scarborough is going to be the face of MSNBC. I mean, I'm not quoting him verbatim, but this is what I'm hearing my sense of it.
Yeah. You can see it.
So,
I mean,
so Fox becomes less crazy, and the truly crazy people on Fox, the Hannitys and whatnot, they go with Trump to Trump TV, which basically wipes out WorldNet Daily and Glenn Beck, which is the hard right competitors.
Well, that's why you can see Glenn Beck right now just sort of floundering around.
Yeah.
Oh, he's down to six employees if the news stories I'm reading are correct.
Yes.
But it raises the question, what is there going to be on the left?
That's true.
You know, you got Free Speech TV, and that's about it.
Yeah.
It, you know, Current went out of business. You know, the nationally funded ones, Al Jazeera is gone. RT is, you know, kind of all over the place. They've got conservatives and liberals and everything else. They're not taking an editorial position. There is no, you know, outside of Free Speech TV, which, you know, is not on most cable systems.
Right.
You know.
One would think there'd be an opening. I mean, I don't want to get into
there is an opening.
A mega, or what's called meta criticism of MSNBC, but they always
do.
Well, you work there, don't you?
I don't care.
Okay. But, I mean, they had, you know, they've had Scarborough during this entire time. They were supposedly a liberal station. And they never built a brand in the way Fox did, where you could turn to Fox and you kind of, even with news and commentary, you knew what you were going to get. It was a very much a mixture of you know, from wonk to non-wonk, from this. They didn't, in my opinion, ever create something where you could expect something that was progressive and smart.
Well, and I mean, their primetime lineup always was. And I think the mistake that happened during the day was...
But that was just a couple hours. What I'm saying is, on Fox, you can turn in any time during the day, and you know what you're going to get
for the
most part. And MSNBC never built that. And if they had, I think you wouldn't have seen those numbers flounder. You know, I mean, clearly, look, Keith Olbermann was a charismatic guy and had a big following. But even when he left, what I'm saying is if they hired some other people that I thought they should have hired at the time, one of them sitting over there. I mean, seriously.
Totally agree.
If they were trying to go for sort of that, I mean, not to mention somebody sitting there, I mean, they could have gotten there. They just chose to mix it up with all sorts of other things.
Well, I don't even think it was an ideological...
There's no consistency
I don't even think
to
it was an ideological problem. I think they made some very bad
and whatever you think of him, I mean,
choices.
Chris Matthews isn't progressive either. I mean, there are times he's sitting there talking about how, you know, sexy George Bush looked up on the aircraft carrier. Yeah. I mean, they never built something where you could consistently expect. And I think if they were to do that, which there clearly seems like they're not going to now, if a station would do that, you could build a serious audience. They just no one's done it.
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't think that the audience on the left is as big as the audience on the right.
No, it's not the same. But
it's a different. I think one of the things inherent in being a liberal is having a wider range of interests.
Maybe
and,
reading,
and
for
it's
example.
Also what it's also
novel
also,
idea.
But it's also why you don't see why you don't see the left mobilize on off-year elections. It's just like they just want to elect people, do good government.
Right.
Whereas on the right, it's always a continuous insurgency. It's a gauntlet. I mean, there's a Masada mentality there, right? Yeah. Where it's like they're at the gates. The who's the they changes with time.
That's right.
Right? You know,
communists, Islamists. As long as it's somebody that's scary.
They're at the gates. You know, we have a big world. You're never going to run out of those boogeymen. At one point, maybe it's boogeymen. I mean,
they have to be eventually.
Right. I mean, honestly,
zombies.
It's right. You know, there are people on the right just like, we've got to find life on another planet because we're running out
of stuff
boogeymen
to be scared of
this one.
Reagan actually suggested that, you'll recall, to Gorbachev.
What's that? Yeah. We got to.
He made the comment that if somebody from outer space would show up, it would unite both our people
and we could
end the Cold War. I mean, you know, it was.
I'll give them something if they, you know, if they feel like sort of changing their positions a little bit, they could get scared of climate change. That's something worth being maybe a little bit scared of. But
indeed.
I don't see that happening with them.
Well, sadly. As long as they're taking money from fossil fuel billionaires, that ain't going to happen.
No,
I mean,
exactly.
That's the, you know, where the Supreme Court corrupted our politics is the Buckley case in 76. That was the point at which the patient was opened and the cancer cells were inserted. And now they're full blown.
It's amazing, too, right? I mean, that's because obviously you think of the 70s and even, or at least with Roe versus Wade and some good things coming out of the court, but not that one. That's where a couple of the conservatives reasserted themselves. And
Let's listen to this this sound of Hillary Clinton calling out Trump's scare tactic on abortion. She did not. I mean, I think by the end she came. She delivered what she needed to deliver, but she it did not seem was fully prepared to address abortion. It seemed to me. And frankly, I was surprised too.
I don't think she was ready for the graphic way in which it was discussed. And one could say maybe she should have been, but that's what I think threw her.
Let's hear her response to Trump's scare tactic. What he was basically saying, there are abortions where you're 4 days away from being born, right. which is just...
Which is illegal, by the way.
Yes.
And just absurd.
I mean, it was one doctor who was doing that. He's in prison right now.
That's right. It's called murder.
Yes.
Or it's called, when you do it and the baby is fine, aside. A C-section.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you do it either in the baby's alive or you don't do it.
Yeah.
Here is Clinton.
If you go with what Hillary is saying, in the ninth month, you can take the baby and rip the baby out of the womb of the mother just prior to the birth of the baby. Now, you can say that that's okay, and Hillary can say that that's okay, but it's not okay with me. Because based on what she's saying and based on where she's going and where she's been, you can take the baby and rip the baby out of the womb in the ninth month. On the final day, and that's not acceptable.
Well, that is not what happens in these cases, and using that kind of scare rhetoric is just terribly unfortunate. You should meet with some of the women that I've met with, women I've known over the course of my life. This is one of the worst possible choices that any woman and her family has to make. And I do not believe the government should be making it. You know, I've had the great honor of traveling across the world on behalf of our country. I've been to countries where governments either forced women to have abortions like they used to do in China or forced women to bear children like they used to do in Romania. And I can tell you the government has no business in the decisions that women make with their families in accordance with their faith, with medical advice. And I will stand up for that right.
Which... arguably is a very conservative position, as in the role of government is not to be in the middle of our lives.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, this it's bizarre to me, these big government Republicans who want to control every aspect of a woman's life.
I thought the second half of that, as I think you were saying, Sam, was very strong. She started off where what I would have liked is her to say, what you're saying is a complete falsehood.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen. You know, that's where she sort of was a little shaky in how to respond initially.
Right.
And then she got her footing, and I thought was really good on it.
Yeah.
Let's go to the other. Donald Trump really wanted his refusal to accept the results of this election to be the top headline. But he had some competition arguing that it was really funny looking at the surrogates trying to explain. Like, he's talking about... Sudanese that come in from the southern border, Syrians,
he said a certain phrase. Is that what you were thinking?
Yes, all hombres, though.
That's
here
right.
is Donald Trump wanting to keep out the hombres.
The bad hombres
from the
among
Sudan
us.
And from Syria.
We have to have strong borders. We have to keep the drugs out of our country. We are right now, we're getting the drugs, they're getting the cash. We need strong borders. We need absolute. We cannot give amnesty. Now, I want to build the wall. We need the wall. The Border Patrol, ICE, they all want the wall. We stop the drugs. We shore up the border. One of my first acts will be to get all of the drug lords, all of the bad ones. We have some bad, bad people in this country that have to go out. We're going to get them out. We're going to secure the border. And once the border is secured, at a later date, we'll make a determination as to the rest. But we have some bad hombres here, and we're going to get them out.
What does hombre mean in Spanish? I thought it meant brother or
friend. Doesn't mean
man. Man?
Yeah.
No, it's just man.
It's just man.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But it can be used in that way. Like, hey, you're a bad hombre, you know? And
he doesn't get credit for this new, this breakthrough policy of getting rid of the drug lords.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, who thought we would want to get rid of the drug lords?
He also sounded a little bit upset. He's like, the drugs are coming here, the money's going there. Almost right. Like if it was going in the reverse direction, he'd be okay with it.
Right.
Right? Like, it was just the direction that was the problem.
It's all about trade.
Exactly.
But honestly, to watch them spin in the spin room, like, he's not just talking about Mexicans. Hombres is a joke.
It's a Nepalese term, too. Hombre.
Yeah, right.
All right, I'm gonna
okay, go.
Leave for a bit. I'm going to leave you guys to talk, but I'll be back in a little bit.
Good to see you.
And here is the other checking off every box, because he really needed to offend everyone. This is Trump calling Hillary a nasty woman. I think he just couldn't control himself. Let's listen to this.
The only kid in the block has
Well, Chris, I am on record as saying that we need to put more money into the Social Security Trust Fund. That's part of my commitment to raise taxes on the wealthy. My Social Security payroll contribution will go up, as will Donald's, assuming he can't figure out how to get out of it. But what we want to do is to replenish the Social Security Trust Fund by making sure that we have sufficient resources. And that will come from either raising the cap and or finding other ways to get more money into it. I will not cut benefits. I want to enhance benefits for low-income workers and for women who have been disadvantaged by the current Social Security system.
I mean, first of all, it's a great knock on him, right? Yeah. See if he can avoid these taxes.
Plus,
as well.
that really cemented things for her, I think, with anybody over 65, anybody who is or close to it, you know, who's looking at Social Security. Yeah.
I mean, that has been the definitively saying I will not cut benefits.
Right.
Is
and in fact, she's going to expand them.
And again, it's not a universal expansion. That's right. What. I think there is, you know, been a big push for. We had COLA increases, cost of living increases, Social Security of something like 0.3%, I think it was just announced.
Right.
We've had more no increases in the cost of living over the past 10 years than we had in the prior 60 years.
Well, this is what Bernie was pointing out, is that the COLA formula for Social Security reflects the cost of living for a 20-something, not
that's
for a 60-something.
Right. That's right. And there is a bureau, I think it's the BLS that puts it out. They do have a specific senior index in terms of inflation that a lot of people have been agitating to use to determine
the COLA.
That was
one of Bernie's big points, and he's right.
And hopefully there'll be an opportunity to, to push that coming in the
Alex Lawson and the people over at Social Security Works are doing such good work on this.
Yep.
Work on this. And the other thing that most people don't realize, and most younger people don't realize, is that everybody in America, I mean literally everybody in America, you're 19 years old, you have a multi-million dollar disaster insurance policy. And you couldn't buy that on the open market. A friend of mine, Michael Hutchison, he was out running. He was in his 40s, went running. He slipped on some ice. He lived in New Mexico. It was a rare icy day. Flipped over a bridge over the edge of the guardrail and fell into the river, hit the ice, broke his neck, and spent the next 14 years of his life until he died, paralyzed from the neck down, and Social Security paid for everything. Mm-hmm. He was not over 65. I mean, every single person in this country has this extraordinary, and it's fully a third of Social Security payments, has this amazing insurance plan. And nobody ever talks about it. It makes me crazy. These guys want to cut Social Security. This is important. Social Security is an insurance program. For people over 65, it's insurance against poverty.
Right.
For people under 65, it's insurance against disaster. This is a moral issue.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it would have been good to see Clinton even, like, you know, to express it this way.
Yeah.
I mean, we need to see more politicians expressing it this way, because it's also incredibly, there's also, you know, a large basis for it to be incredibly popular with the American public.
Yep.
So it's not like, you know, it's a sales job that you're going uphill. It's all downhill in terms of what you're pushing. All right. Joining us now also, Ari Ravenhop.
Ari Ravenhop.
Now, you did
the minor Ari Ravenhop.
You did your program this morning at 3 a.m. local time.
3 a.m. local time.
How'd that go?
It went. We did it. We survived. We've gotten through. We're here. We're awake. We haven't gone to sleep yet. We'll see when the pain hits.
Are you guys, is there, let me ask you this. Do you anticipate, what do you think is going to happen with Merrick Garland? I'm curious as to both of your thoughts on this. I mean,
That's interesting. I think if Hillary wins and Democrats take back the Senate, there will be a move among Republicans to slam him through. What's interesting is it would be a huge violation of process to do that.
In what way?
Traditional process. President appoints a Supreme Court nominee. Supreme Court nominee does like a week of like visits, shakes hands with everybody, schmoozes it up. Then the Senate Judiciary Committee sends a questionnaire to the White House. We would like you to submit the following documents. Here are questions about your life. Please answer this. The nominee takes a week and a half in the White House to get everything, gather all the paper, fight about certain pay. If the person worked in the executive branch, there'll typically be a fight about executive privilege and which papers go and which papers don't. And then they submit the paperwork to the Senate. The Senate spends a little bit of time looking at the paperwork. Then they have a confirmation hearing, right? Then confirmation hearings go 3 days. Then, and typically then, votes at the end of that. Then it goes to the floor the next week. The issue is, the Senate never even sent the questionnaire to the White House. So if you were to slam it through during lame duck, if they were to, like, go at warp speed.
Oh, you think they're going to do this during lame duck?
If they were going to do it, they'd do it during lame duck.
I don't think they can, though.
I don't think they can. Yeah. They have too much else to do, well, and they're going to be fighting over budget.
And the other elephant in the room
well,
is
Well, so
that,
then the question is, does she appoint someone new?
Well, that's the elephant in the room, is that she has said right. that her litmus test is, will they repeal Citizens United? And Merrick Garland is on record in support of Citizens United.
But so, is he on record? I mean, in speech
well,
now.
Well, he may well be
speech
on.
Speech now.
It may be stare
decisis. Yes. I mean, in yeah. speech now, he ruled consistent with Citizens United, but he's doing that at an appellate court level, knowing that that had just been handed down.
And That's citing right. that precedent.
And citing yes. that precedent.
But he could have challenged.
He upheld a series of campaign finance regulations for pre-Citizens United.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, that's a good question.
So I mean, we don't know. And you know, and by the way, President Obama went to Orrin Hatch and said, okay, I want to get a nominee who's actually acceptable to the Republican Party and to me. Who do you recommend? Orrin Hatch said Merrick Garland.
And then he said, psych.
He actually said that all publicly?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
I mean,
and so Merrick Garland is the choice of one of the most conservative Republicans in the United States Senate. They still had to oppose him because, as Jane Mayer pointed out in her brilliant book, Dark Money, you know, they had that debate, Jeff Flake and John Cornyn, in front of a room full of billionaires about 3 weeks after Obama was sworn in. It was the second. It followed the caucus room conspiracy, where Flake was taking the position that we should oppose them on absolutely mm-hmm. everything, even the stuff we agree on, because we want to just destroy Obama and make sure that America never votes for somebody
now,
like him again.
Now, there's a second problem, which is why they won't do it in lame duck, though, which is Trump loses. Democrats have taken the Senate. Both Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell are going to be worried about their jobs a little bit. Trump is not going to go away.
Oh, God, no.
He's going to be out there screaming about random stuff. And if the Senate accedes to Merrick Garland, he'll be out there saying, see, they should be blocking every nominee. They're right. caving, you know, and I think that you'd create some of the Republicans who would be scared of facing primary challenges in 2018 would say, well, you can't bring this up, yada, 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 let Schumer do it. The question is, then, does Schumer do it between January 4th and January 22nd?
You're asking, does Schumer do, does he get Merrick Garland through?
Because Schumer's logic would be, I'm not having an opinion on this, I'm just going over logic is, if Republicans are going to filibuster, Schumer will probably have no compunction, and the Democratic caucus will have no compunction about nuclear option for Supreme Court, majority vote. At that point, he's going to say, I'd rather do it 3 weeks before, like, put it on the last nominee. Don't make Hillary's, like, first thing a big nuclear Senate. That way, Hillary can come in, say, the Senate did it, like, not my deal. Schumer did it.
Mm-hmm.
Schumer, this is procedural. Schumer says, yeah, I did it because they were going to spend the next 2 years blocking stuff, and I'm done with this.
Yeah.
We're doing it now. And it's actually easier to do the nuclear option on the first day the Senate's in session.
So because the rules are reset.
Well, they're not, but there's a debate about whether they could be.
Right.
If you're going to pull the nuclear option in terms of SCOTUS.
Yeah.
And you know in 2018 that the Democrats are likely to lose control of the Senate. At that point, right?
You want to have 2 years of most. That way, do it the first day and be done.
Do it. You do it the first day because you are also basically encouraging
Ruth Bader Ginsburg to retire
and Breyer.
And Breyer.
Well, mainly Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
And Kennedy.
Yeah,
and, well, Kennedy's not going to take his cue necessarily.
No, well, Kennedy's cue to retire is different. Kennedy's cue to retire is Kennedy likes being nothing more.
Right, when he realizes he's not the swing vote
when he's
anymore,
not the swing vote,
and
it's
nobody
gonna
cares about it.
It's going to get real
Kennedy.
Boring for him
right.
when nobody cares about him anymore, and he's going to be like, I'm
Bye.
Out. And by the way, there's also the rumor that
Clarence Thomas is bored,
out of his mind, yeah. doesn't want to be there anymore, doesn't want to be on the court, wants to go around giving speeches and getting rich, and he feels held back because of the focus on his wife's ethics, and he just wants to get out and go make money.
How does he feel held back on the? Like, where is there
no,
evidence
about the ability to make money?
Oh, I see.
So he's like, I don't care anymore, and if the court is 6-3 at that point,
right?
7-2.
I mean, I guess that's the question: is like, wouldn't you want someone younger than Merrick Garland?
Yes, but here's the thing. Merrick Garland still isn't that old. Remember, people are, like, justices can serve into their 80s.
Yeah,
and
so,
frequently do.
Yeah, so I'm not that, like, look, if the court is reshaped in this way, see, I'm not as concerned about Citizens United. I think Barack Obama's very legacy conscious at this point, and he doesn't want a George H.W. Bush problem, which is appointing a judge that upheld Roe.
Mm-hmm.
And for him, that decision is the equivalent of Citizens United.
Right.
I don't think he'd appoint Garland if he was not confident Citizens United would be overturned by Garland.
Mm. Well, that's interesting.
Because of a legacy issue.
It would be very problematic for his legacy to have appointed, you know, right? Like to have appointed a justice who ended up, the one vote that he's voting with the conservative majority is against a Citizens United type.
Yep.
Well, Hillary Clinton's going to have a couple of bites at the apple. I mean, it's
the question is how many of those are going to come in the first 2 years. I mean, right. It's quite possible, it seems to me, that is all that we're going to be talking about for the next 2 years, because it's quite possible that Ruth Bader Ginsburg says on day one, I'm resigning. And so
let's just say that at the end of the term.
At the end of her term in the fall.
In July.
She wouldn't necessarily say it before then?
No, July. I mean, she might not, because she wouldn't. There'll be hints about it because she won't go hire clerks for the next year. That's always the big tell. Somebody doesn't go hire clerks. They're like, okay, they're not planning on coming back.
But it does also create more pressure and give cover for the Democrats to do the nuclear option or whatnot. But
she's going to want that done because she said she wants her replacement to be as liberal as her, and she could not do this in this world. And my sense is if they nuclear option it, you would get a Goodwin Liu on the court.
Goodwin Liu, yes.
You get somebody of that. Okay. Goodwin Liu is a very progressive judge in California who was on Barack Obama's shortlist, and Barack Obama likes a lot, but he couldn't get
confirmed. They couldn't get him through.
Like, no way they can get him through the Senate. They couldn't get him through the Senate one other time.
Yeah.
You'd get judges like that.
It's going to be an interesting...
Or Ivanka Trump.
Just as a peace offer.
Well, you know, so you got to go to the center. And she was such a good judge on The Apprentice. And there's no constitutional requirement of a law degree, so...
No, I think it would be actually healthy to have a non-lawyer... Or non-judge, anyways.
I disagree.
You don't think?
I do. Yeah, there's so much intricacy involved.
Well, Elena Kagan wasn't a judge.
No, but she was a lawyer.
She was a lawyer. Yeah.
I mean, that just kind of basic education in the law. I would be very, very opposed.
I'm just trying to keep the door open for myself.
Yeah. Sam Cedar.
You're Jewish. It's fine. That's basically a lawyer.
I went for a year. I went to law school for a year. I mean, that's got to count.
Did you?
You got to start.
Yeah, sure.
Really?
You did not know that?
I think Donald Trump is starting a correspondence course.
I can finish
Trump it off University?
Trump University.
Well, Liberty University has a law school.
That would be awesome.
Do you think they'd accept you?
That would be, I mean, maybe just to sort of...
Affirmative
see,
action?
See, yeah, see how diverse we are? We brought in this... This Jewy white guy. Let's listen to. Do you have earplugs?
I'll find some.
All right. I want to play one more clip of sound here.
Can I borrow your power while we listen?
My power?
Can I charge my laptop, basically?
Yeah, you can, but we're only going to be 3 minutes.
Hand it over here. It'll give you like a,
yeah, just don't unplug the show, please.
And don't hit the switch.
Exactly. So here's Kellyanne Conway on with Chris Cuomo this morning, defending Trump's unwillingness to say that he's going to support the outcome of the election. This is, I don't know, it's always fun to like watch Chris Cuomo sort of preen about sort of normalcy and what norms. Let's listen to this.
Can I speak today? Thank
please,
you. I really
please.
Appreciate that.
I just, you know,
that.
I don't want you to condemn you know the media as an answer to this question.
I didn't condemn the media. I gave you a statistic, principles of American democracy. Let's ask the lady who was Secretary of State, where they were using...
Go ahead.
Respectfully, can I speak today? Thank
please,
you. I really
please.
Appreciate that.
I just, you know,
that.
I don't want you to condemn you know the media as an answer to this question.
I didn't condemn the media. I gave you a statistic, 96%. That's super close to 100%. That's a really high number of journalists who gave
super
their money to Hillary Clinton's
term.
Campaign over Donald Trump. We know from these, if you just turn on a TV or read the print every day, you know the guy can't get a fair shake. But all that aside, if you want to talk about who has disrupted and disrespected the underlying principles of American democracy, let's ask the lady who was Secretary of State, where they were using it as a concierge for foreign donations. Let's ask the lady who is allowing collusion between the Department of Justice, the FBI, and the State Department. I mean, it's outrageous to think this person who said we went from dead broke to being a quarter billionaire selling what? Access to the government, undermining our democratic principles. But you guys don't want to talk about that. There was so much talked about last night. What about Donald Trump challenging Hillary Clinton, her just ignoring him, challenging her to give back the Clinton Foundation money that has been taken from countries that disrespect women, that, as Donald Trump pointed out, Chris, throws gays off of buildings, disrespects women. She never even replied. Do you think today that will happen? Do you think anybody at CNN will ask people at the Clinton Foundation where
so,
men are paid more than women?
But don't you
understand
going to
give
that
the money
this,
back? I doubt
but Kellyanne,
it.
The suggestion that what we should cover is something that we have known and covered for weeks and months should take supremacy over a man who's about to be president of the United States if he wins an election,
thank
saying,
you.
I won't accept it. I won't accept it if I don't win. Fundamentally, that's what he said. We've never
he did not,
heard
Chris,
it before.
He did not say that. Chris, he did not, excuse me, he did not say, I won't accept it if I don't win. He said, let's see what happens.
He said, I want to keep
meaning,
you in suspense.
Let's see how close it is.
The GOP head, Reince Priebus,
Chris,
all these different GOP lawmakers came forward and said that was wrong. Laura Ingraham said, he has to say that he'll accept it unless there's
and
another
flaw. And I said yesterday, I've said I'm his campaign manager, his running mate, his daughter. We've all said the same thing. Absent widespread fraud or indices of irregularities, but please don't say he said, quote, unless I win.
He didn't
win,
say it. He said, I won't
he
tell you
that.
Until then. He didn't say what you said either. He didn't say, oh, look, if there's a huge irregularity or something like that, like Florida, then we have to look at it. He didn't say that. He said, I don't know. I'll look at it when it happens. I want to keep you in suspense. He didn't say what you said.
So he was supposed to give 10 or 12 different hypotheticals to prove his point.
No, he was supposed to say, I accept the outcome of the election because we want a peaceful transfer of power. And then if there's some God forbid that happens, like in 2000, you deal with it when it comes. You don't undermine the system before you come to that.
Because, you know,
there's a stat I have to bring out, Sam.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Kellyanne Conway said 100%, 96% of journalists gave to Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump. I have a very important stat. 100% of Donald Trump's children have given more to Hillary Clinton than Donald Trump. True fact. Donald Trump's kids have given $8,800 to Hillary Clinton's campaigns and $0 to Donald Trump's campaigns.
So it's not necessarily indicative of where they stand. But here's what's more, I think, more important about this exchange. And I keep referencing this piece that Jay Rosen wrote about how Trump has basically short-circuited the media's ability to deal with a campaign. Because usually what will happen is they'll have their surrogates on. They will question the surrogates. And any inconsistency between what the surrogates are saying and the candidate says, you know, is basically becomes the regulator, right, on some level. Like, this is what keeps things from going off the rails. Because people have to... But what we're watching here is all the surrogates having no stakes whatsoever
in the fact that Trump is saying one thing and they're saying another. Like, these are questions, it seems to me, that need to be asked of Republican electeds who endorse it, who actually have something to lose in by saying that there's distance here. You know, like, the idea that, Paul Ryan could get away with what he said was patently racist, like the definition of racism. All right, guys, see you later. And just sort of skulks off. That's the problem with the media.
I think what we have to keep in mind is that Paul Ryan right now is running for president 4 years from now. Kellyanne Conway is not, you know, helping Donald Trump run for president. I mean, she's appearing to, but she's got future plans. Donald Trump isn't running for president any longer. I mean, you know, he says he is, but he's running for his next big step, whatever it may be, his TV network. That there
he's
are
running for bankruptcy.
Yeah, there are these secondary agendas that are driving not only all of his surrogates, they all have their own, you know, gee, I hope I end up with a show on Fox kind of thing.
Right.
But also him. And Chris Cuomo is, you know, concerned about his future and career with CNN.
That's why they should be going to electeds. Instead of having these surrogates on, they should be going to electeds and making, because they're the only
ones. But the electeds are unwilling to talk about it.
There's nobody who will come. Like, the reason you have all these, let's be honest, TV has become painful. Like, CNN in particular has become painful because they're bigger surrogates who are, like, actually coherent human beings will not come on and defend Trump.
Right.
And some won't even come on and talk about Trump. I know this from some of them. They're like, I don't even want to get into, like, the condemning Trump anymore because it's a waste of my time. And so they're like, I told CNN, like, I can't come on for Trump segments right now. So you've seen a few CNN surrogates, like, completely disappear. And you have Jeffrey Lord and Scotty Nell Hughes and now Kellyanne. And that's why also Rudy Giuliani's out there.
Right. They're really scraping the bottom.
Like,
of the
they can't even get Chris Christie anymore.
Chris Christie is 16 inches from an indictment.
Yes.
You know,
and I think he realizes, like, he's just like, I've got to figure out, I got to get a plan.
And he doesn't want to be asked about
plan D.
It.
Yeah. I noticed last night in the spin room, it was stunning.
Because
I originally thought, like, oh, I'm going to go there and I'm going to mock Scott Brown and I'm going to be able to do my Massachusetts accent. There was nobody there. Like,
you got Katrina Pearson. There's
I got Katrina Pearson, but James O'Keefe. Like, I mean, there was no.
Was he spinning for Trump?
He claimed he was not spinning for Trump. He was just
brought
there.
Did he have an O'Keefe sign?
He was actually in the pen. Like, he was one of the big time.
It was all Breitbart people all the time.
It was like.
He'll have a segment on Trump's new TV network.
Mike Huckabee's daughter was there.
Yes, she did. She did all the debates. She's their youth person.
There was no elected officials.
Right. Whereas Democrats, I know Javier Becerra was there.
Oh yeah, there was all.
And all Jeff these Sessions Democrats were like, there? "Can we please come?"
Jeff Sessions was there.
Yeah.
He was on my flight.
He was on the other side, but it was very, very sparse.
Yeah.
I mean, it was.
It's why they have to have Mike Pence at the debates, like. Vice presidents don't come to the debates to sit in the audience and cheer. It's a waste of scheduling space. But they don't have anyone else, so they have to take their VP, who, by the way,
theoretically could be campaigning somewhere.
Yeah, and has to be in the spin room.
That's fascinating.
And he was clearly so uncomfortable. I mean, you know.
There is no level of.
Well, he's running for 2020.
Yeah.
I mean, look, you have Mike Pence, who's going to be the I was loyal to Donald Trump segment of the ticket. You're going to have Paul Ryan, who's going to get slaughtered by this Republican Party if he runs for president. You have, like, Ted Cruz.
Cotton,
Ted Cruz,
Kasich,
who's going to be the.
Rubio.
Well, Kasich won't run.
You don't think Kasich will run?
No. I think Kasich's going to go get rich.
He's going to what?
Again?
Yeah.
He's going to. I'm sorry, I missed what you said.
I think Kasich's going to go get rich.
Oh, he's going to go back on Fox.
No, I think he's going to go, like, make real
back
money.
Back to Wall Street.
Oh, that's right. He was running Lehman Brothers in Ohio, wasn't he?
Yeah, so I think he's going to go back and do that and be like, I'm done with this. You know what?
Yeah.
I'll go on TV every once in a while, but I'm going to go make bank money.
Sure.
Because I can go do that.
Sure.
Because
that makes perfect sense.
Like, I took my shot. Now I'm going to go make some cash.
Right. I'm in the history books. And now it's time to get
rich. And I actually think he's going to become, like, a very centrist, like, bipartisan, like, he'll get a seat at, like, the bipartisan policy institute and be like a John Huntsman.
or Jack Kemp.
Kick like the Tyco. Can. They'll be sponsoring yes. the Kick the Can programs.
By the way, can we talk about that for a second? I don't yes. want to hijack your show.
No, please do, because we're going to wrap up soon.
But the Pete Peterson line of questioning last night.
Oh, God.
That was insane.
Made me ill. And here's the thing. I was looking this up this morning. Someone's like, did Pete Peterson sponsor the Commission on Presidential Debates? I checked. I went through Pete Peterson's. Pete Peterson is fairly transparent in how he contributes because he does everything through his foundation. So you can look at where his foundation's contributed. Nothing to the Commission on Presidential Debates ever in his thing. So that's not it. But then you look at his contributions and you realize, you know, he's given $300,000 on his last reports to the Economic Policy Institute, which we love, which, like great progressive. And we're not even talking like CAP, which is more yeah. standard Democrat, where he gave like another $300,000 to. Right, where he spread so much money around the city with his money, he's created this world where he is the center because he gives to everybody. And I think it's high time. Look, it's a lot of money, but progressive groups are going to need to make a choice here, because by allowing
reject
him to give money to
right.
them, they normalize that position to a point where Chris Wallace can say, well, the center on, you know, he get money to center on budget policy priorities, like you. Like, Tom, Sam, we use these people on our show every day. They're all Peterson-funded.
Right.
And they're like, well, we're funded for these individual projects that are good.
Right.
But the problem is it's normalized his position
right.
in the
media. Right, it's a functional equivalent of saying, like, well, look, my camera's sponsored by them, but not my microphones.
Yes.
I mean, yeah, it's ridiculous.
So, I mean, so then you get, like, a really bad framing.
And there's this reluctance of politicians to push back on that sort of central sort of debt hawkery that nobody wants to be willing to take on this conventional
well, let's
waiver.
Let's
they
be,
just don't feel like it's worth it.
Let's be clear. Nobody is. And I don't say this as an insult because he's probably better than anybody else at it. I wrote a profile for the American Prospect for about Bernie Sanders way back before he even ran for president.
He also is a debt hawk.
Well, no, he plays debt hawk. And, like, his...
He had Stephanie Kelton as part of his
No,
his
I know,
staff,
but...
And I think it shows an openness to that understanding.
I think it shows an openness, but you... Like, one of his staff members said to me, the reason he voted against the Iraq War was because it was going to debt. And I go, that's just not true. Like, if there's a war that's the right war, then the position should be we do go into it. If there's a
right.
war that – if World War II happens, guess what?
Yeah.
Go into debt.
And it took us to 127% of GDP as our debt.
Right.
It's like the largest since the Civil War.
So, like, it's not necessarily – like, debt isn't bad on its own. Why is the Iraq War debt bad? Because it was a waste of money and resources. Like, it's bad because we don't need to be spending that
and
money.
Because of what the money bought, just
right.
death and destruction for – hundreds of thousands
with
of
no
people
benefit.
No benefit.
Well, it was like, sorry, Tom.
No, it was just the point that the American people once again don't get. That's just so rational. Is if you take $1 billion and you put it into roads, you're providing the soil for business to grow in. You take $1 billion and you put it into bombs and drop them on somebody, you've just wasted $1 billion.
Also, there's a lie they tell, and it's a fairly complex one, but it's one I need to like be anal about. I wrote about this for The Nation, and it's a really wonky point. So when they say debt is going to be 86% of GDP, that is not true. Let me explain how they're coming to that. For that to take place, they have to claim that to fund the Social Security shortfall, government's going to issue bonds and take out debt. The problem is that can't happen because it's so Congress would need to affirmatively change the law to say Social Security will be funded with debt. Right now, you cannot fund Social Security with debt. It's against the law. Congress would need to go in. And there are 12 different bills in Congress, progressive and conservative, that talk about how to reduce the 2030 shortfall in Social Security. Some are raising the cap, which is the more progressive
right.
solution, and some are benefit cuts, which is the Pete Peterson and crony solution. Not a single bill, I think since the 1940s, has ever suggested that Social Security should be allowed to take out debt. So they're literally in a hypothetical, non-existent world on that number.
And there's also, you hear, like, we're going to be facing...
I've got a boogie.
Okay.
I got to do my own
Tom,
show again.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. you hear them talk about the $70 trillion of unfunded liability, yeah, which presumes that we're going to have to pay out Social Security to people 50 years from now, and that between now and that year 50, they will not work.
Well, the numbers,
and they'll just they'll go away and then come back in time for retirement.
The numbers always sound huge, right? So it always sounds like, oh my God, it's a $17 trillion. Except that's not how you measure debt. You measure debt. If Sam Cedar takes out a million-dollar loan, mm-hmm, that's a lot. I'm presuming that's a lot of money for Sam Cedar.
Well, I mean, these microphones don't come cheaply.
Exactly. And Sam Cedar, that would be a big amount of debt that could hamstring Sam Cedar's life. If Donald Trump takes out a million-dollar loan, well, maybe. If Warren Buffett takes out a million-dollar loan, that's like you and I putting $5 on a credit card. It
right,
doesn't matter.
Right.
And when a government takes $17 trillion out, that doesn't, that number's meaningless, especially since governments have something magic that you don't have, Sam.
The ability to print money.
Yes. Well, federal
and
government.
And taxation.
Yes. Which state governments don't have the ability to print money, which is why when Mike Pence is like, I was a governor and I balanced the budget.
Well,
yes,
yeah,
governors should
law,
balance
right,
the budget. First off, it's by law. Second, governors don't have printing presses that print out money.
Right. All right. Well, I think we're going to wrap it up.
That's sad.
I know. Because I have to go to the bathroom.
Really?
Yeah.
One or two.
This is the type of quality programming.
The people want to know, Sam. You're ending the show.
Because it's all Howard Stern Network for you guys.
It's like, look, that's my employer.
I've got to.
Baba Booey.
It's a number one. It's a number
hit him
one
with the hind, Sam. Hit him with the hind.
All right, folks. Well, we'll be back tomorrow. Going to hopefully have a lineup of attorneys who are going to come and speak to us about a return to our regular programming that we generally have at the Mass Torts Conference. But Ari, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sam.
People can find you, obviously, on SiriusXM.
Ari Rabinhoff on Twitter, on SiriusXM.
Yeah.
Agenda Ari on Facebook.
The Agenda, that's right.
Generally wandering the streets of Las Vegas between 2 and 3 in the morning looking for radio studios.
Apparently, like, yeah, exactly. Ari spends like half his life here.
I kind of do, but the best part was I walked out of the radio studio at 6 a.m. and I called an Uber, and the Uber went in the wrong parking lot, so I'm running with my phone to the Uber.
Dude, why are you using Uber? Why don't you use Curbed?
It's because it didn't have it here, because they won't pick me up at the thing. I need to use Uber.
They have Curbed.
Oh, I was told it didn't work here. I use Curbed all the time. I was told they didn't work here.
You used it last night?
I got lied to.
Of course. Of course you did.
The guy thought I was going to shoot him with my phone.
You do need to have an address, though. You need to, like, you can't just drop a pin here.
I always use an address. I don't trust the pin.
All right, folks. We'll see you tomorrow.
And that's it, girl, strength that got to get to where I want. But I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made. For the option where you don't get paid. For the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somewhere I lost my drive. Between the 101 and the 5. Do you know takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. Into years, bright.